Welcome to Components. We have Jeffrey McIntyre from Bucket Studio here with us today. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Hello, thanks for having me, Patrick.
I'm glad you're here and welcome back to Components. And today we're going to be talking about your chapter in the Content Operations book, which is coming out very soon or has already come out, depending on when it is that you're listening to this. How are you? How are things?
Things are good. Thanks again for having me here. I feel like this is one of the better venues for us to talk about expressing content and getting into sort of a systematic stance with our products and places by componentizing the content. So three cheers for Components.
Cool. Well, three cheers for you for being here. I really appreciate you coming and taking the time. And yeah, I mean, this is a great forum for this. Obviously, we strive to be as nerdy as possible, and a lot of this stuff gets really complicated, which you dive into really nicely in your chapter, which is chapter 7 of the Content Operations book and is titled Personalization and Content Operations. So do you want to start by just giving us a little bit of background on what brought you to the Content Operations book project, and then we can go in and talk about the actual contents of your chapter a little bit.
For sure. So I believe Carlos was the first to reach out to me with this project. And of course, I said yes immediately because if nothing else, I'd like to think of myself as an enabler, somebody who is very bent on helping content professionals realize the opportunity they have, both in their career, but also in making a wee dent in the wider digital universe. I feel like the canvas that content professionals operate on is always expanding. And so there's the tendency to sort of hopscotch and say, oh, AI, that's the new thing we should be talking about. But I think that there's also so much rigor and background that content professionals bring to a discussion of things like AI, but it could be personalization or many other topics. And that's actually a huge part of their value add. And so when Carlos talked to me about the project, I was immediately excited because to me, oh, here's a tiny little bullhorn that I can shout into and sort of share some of my sort of rah-rah speech about my experience getting into designing for personalized experiences and the difference that some clients have seen, and just how repeatable and reproducible these kinds of activities can be for content professionals that think at the level of systems. And as we know with content operations, it is nothing if not else thinking in terms of systems and how to express content across multiple systems of record.
Yeah, I think that's very, very true. I mean, this book is probably one of the only places where the audience coming in is by default going to have a systems approach to the way that they're looking at these things. And one of the things that really struck me in your chapter is just how you actually came in and started thinking about this, you know, very holistically and really starting with the practice of it before getting into the technical implementation of it. So you spent a lot of time talking about kind of the background of why, I would say, and use some analogies in there that I think are pretty powerful as well. So before we get into like the details of that though, like, can you just kind of go through the broad strokes of, you know, what your chapter is and what your intention for your chapter was when you started writing it for the Content Operations book?
Yeah, I wanted to respect that, you know, personalization is really due its own very specific focus when we think about content operations and the role of a content professional in any complex experience or product or place. And there's a lot of myths out there about personalization. And it starts right at the forefront. What is the definition of personalization? I received an in-app notification this morning for the NBA app, and they were touting their All-Star game coming up, and they said, personalize your app today by picking your favorite teams, players, events, which is not personalization per se. It's actually customization. And so anytime that the user has agency on a automated experience or a simplified experience, that's actually customization. So I wanted to be really attentive without being pedantic or too flowery and say, actually, when we talk about personalization, we're talking about a range of customized, personalized, or automated experiences. And they all go towards one end, which is simplifying an experience for an end user. And I think that I wanted to make sure that people understood that value proposition because a lot of people get tied up in the difficulty of delivering or maintaining a personalized experience. A lot of people have had challenges with these projects. A lot of people have misgivings about certain vendors or even whole software categories that have made blue sky promises about, just automate all of the things. It's no problem. And I wanted to say, actually, if we take a clear-eyed view of this, there is a lot of cool stuff you can do, and you can start by studying some of the work of Colin Egan. Colin Egan is a colleague of mine and a designer who works at Faden, which is an agency, a CX agency. And he's one of the key points of inspiration for me when I repositioned around connected experience about 8 or 9 years ago. Here was a guy who was saying, you as a UXer at some point in your career are going to need to design for personalization. And what that really means is designing with data. And for a lot of designers, that will be the first time they engage with a canvas that's that broad and that complex in terms of, okay, well, what audience am I speaking to? What data am I calling up? How is it expressed? When? All of these questions. And so I wanted to sort of tell the story of designing for personalization from what I've learned from Colin, but also make sure that I'm getting a lot of the value prop in because people who've had, adverse sort of reactions to personalization, either as a consumer, like this is creepy, or as a practitioner, oh man, this is so hard to do. There must be a better way. And I want to say in this chapter, there is a better way.
That's a great introduction. And there's just a lot of things in there that I want to unpack. First of all, if there's a place to be pedantic, I think it's probably here. So
How about the show notes? Maybe we could shovel it into the show notes, pedantic only there.
there you go. So I wouldn't worry about that part. But one of the things that you called out in there that I think is really critical when starting to think about personalization, it's the thing that struck me because I think I have the same challenge with it that everybody, well, not maybe not everybody, but a lot of people tend to have, which is that there's this fine line between making things easier for a customer or whoever the user is, so that they can move through something more quickly. And what I think most people start to see is manipulation, right? And for me, I've always really struggled to kind of pull those two things apart. Because like, where do you go? Like, when do you cross the line from, okay, a customer is seeking to purchase this, and all I'm doing is saving them time on the path to it and getting to a place where a customer has no intention of purchasing this, and they probably don't need to, but I'm going to use algorithms to appeal to them in a way which is arguably not in their best interest because I'm trying to generate revenue from this person. Like, how do you think about that balance?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and I think there's a few ways to look at it. Number one, the finest products and places I have worked had the benefit, great honor of working on, have had experiences that had business benefit and user benefit tied into these key interactions that were automated and simplified and so forth. Number two, there is always going to be a need. So this is an interesting conversation that those of us who do a lot of personalization work like to debate, which is, will we always need to define and deliver a default experience? My answer is yes. You will always legally need to create a more static, renderable service or experience. The whole proposition behind customizing experience versus personalizing it, for example, is again giving the user the onus, and everyone knows their system's preferences in every, given software is the classic example of customization. There's no chance for a user feeling ostracized or manipulated in that kind of context. And so sometimes it's just as simple as let's not make too many assumptions and land ourselves into what I call a perso fail, where, and I've got examples of those in the chapter. Let's avoid overfitting. And the data people will know what I'm talking about with that. So you try to sort of anticipate these sorts of things, Patrick. And also give cues in the user interface. Why am I being shown this? And not make it a takeover so that users don't have, again, a default experience. You might present an onboarding wizard, for example, but make it optional. And if the user doesn't want to express what their interests are or what industry they're in, let's not fool ourselves here. Trust is at the heart of all of this. I have Colin and I have created a card game that we're just in the process of revising for presenting at the IA conference. And one of the cards is trust. And so when you're thinking about the sort of alchemy of how a user is going to react to something, we must design responsibly. And you know what? The law is just right behind us if we don't. So I think there's actually a lot of great stuff coming down the road for practitioners in terms of, ethics. And think of it as like almost a Hippocratic oath, where you're going to need to be able to explain the rationale for these kinds of automations.
Very interesting. So can you actually just say a little bit more on the pure legal aspect of this? That's not something that I'm terribly familiar with.
So as we know with GDPR and other now commonplace digital personal information laws, one of the rights that users have is to data destruction. So not only can I grant you permission, but I can revoke that permission for you to gather data from me. And so one of the things that I've noticed among customers, prospects, and even peers that I talk to is a lot of bulking up. And this is principally in the enterprise, but it's certainly affecting small and medium-sized businesses too, because they all use either a marketing automation platform or a CMS or a DAM or what have you. And there needs to be an auditable trace by which you can both explain why somebody received something and undo or destroy their data, their personal data records at some point. So there's always going to be, in my mind, a need for a default experience, if only because you might be geofenced in a certain way that people, legally cannot provide you the classic UI. They have to assume, actually, unless you're using a fancy VPN, we assume you're in this country, so we're going to give you this localized experience. And so I think on the data side of it, you start to get into things that are going to make it very specific that we need to be faithful to the user foremost.
Very interesting. That makes a lot of sense. I hadn't really thought about the legal backings of personalization. I mean, really at all recently, but I think that there's a lot of thinking and planning that needs to go there, which I think is one of the themes of your chapter. Very broadly, I feel like you really lean on this concept of planning ahead, like thinking really deeply about the ways that you're approaching personalization. And maybe I have a bias here, and this was my reading of this, so I want your take on this. But I felt like the way that you were advising in your chapter was, a a little bit goes a long way, and to start small. Is that a fair takeaway from the way that you position your position as you're writing this?
Yes. Yeah, and I espouse that largely irrespective of the maturity of the organization or its talent equation and the resources it has, because I've seen organizations even that are resource plentiful or budget plentiful that cha they overwhelm themselves with this territory because it can be so sweeping and so broad. And then they try to do too much too soon.
Yeah. And then I think that's where you can sometimes get into, kind of the murky waters of overfitting and mistargeting and those kinds of things where, yeah, and that so as I'm thinking through this, I'm thinking about that and I'm wondering, like, okay, if you go into this and maybe unintentionally you go a little too far with personalization, do you feel like that's going to give you misleading metrics that could be part of the reason that people fall out of the personalization journey? Or is that not something that you're terribly concerned about?
That's an interesting question. I think it comes down a bit to the kind of software you're using to generate these experiences. So I do know for a personalization engine, that's a suite software category that typically provides functionality for you to personalize your presentation layer. With various design elements. It also usually allows you to do either content or product recommendations, and it'll have some very, basic to robust algorithms for that. Those things also come with rules engines. And so one of the things that the software has become quite good at since when I started a decade ago looking at this territory as an opportunity space that needed more of us practitioners leaning into, is that they can now deconflict what would otherwise be conflicting personalizations or automations. So, for example, if I'm on a retail or e-commerce website and I'm browsing swimsuits, and they want to promote parkas. There were times in the past where people could get, bombarded with something that wasn't seasonal just because there was an overlying, rubric that said, anyone from this geography, we want to promote our winter weather gear. And they didn't know I was planning a vacation, or they didn't know that, And that's the kind of thing is these rules engines tend to lay out all of your things right in a tidy list, and you can see the where, when, what, hows. One of the things I talk about in the chapter is there is an underlying grammar to personalized experience. I think it's the most important thing that a content professional can bring forward is they best understand content data and information. They know it intimately, and they can understand the different audiences, all of the whos. They can understand the whens in terms of what are the key moments in the journey that people would want to personalize, the hows. And again, part of that is a measurement function. So to circle back to your question, I think it partly depends on what you're measuring. Certainly, you can have parts of an organization that are very conversion focused. And that may cloud questions of what is the quality of the user experience or customer satisfaction. But the best organizations I find have parties that are interested in customer effort score. They might be interested in NPS. They're also doing, widgets on the page, and they have a bit more of a holistic view of measurement. And as I say, a lot of this software has gotten quite savvy about preventing kind of user error. Where, we've got field marketing working on these promotions, and yet we've got merchandising people over here doing this, and then there's a conflict with physical stores, and all of that stuff really is about complexity. And I think this is where content professionals can reign. They can really, really think doggedly about these things and be the people that help simplify both the experience of running these personalizations. But also ensure that the user's point of view is kept intact and that we're not just clobbering people with too many notifications, or just letting ourselves flex too much just because we could personalize this thing, should we?
So you hit on something that I wanted to ask you, which is, can you just talk about what the grammar of personalization is? It's something you go through quite a bit in your chapter, and you referenced it there quickly, but I think we should actually go and define it for our audience.
Yeah. What it comes down to is these tools, whether you're talking about a marketing automation platform or a CMS or something homegrown you've got in your stack that does a mixture of recommendations, notifications, and these sorts of personalizations on the presentation layer of a screen or page. Is there is it seems overwhelming, it seems oceanic. There was one personalization engine vendor that used to show a picture of the ocean and said, kind of like a now what? You can go anywhere, which I always thought was kind of interesting because to me it was like, well, that's you're actually selling the complexity of your solution, and not the sure-footedness of like true north is this way. And
Yep.
so a lot of people don't find that far ashore. Actually, though, there are only a finite number of elements that you can personalize on a page. And so if we go back to Colin Egan, his great innovation to date, and he's talked widely, he and I both serve on the Consortium of Personalization Professionals and are very active in talking up this opportunity from a design perspective. He said, think of your screens as a city map. And just like a city consists of zones, meaning you've got residential over here, you've got commercial over here. It's kind of a harkening back to the old days of web design where it was like we would tussle over who had what real estate below the fold, above the fold, and key templates and so on. And but he's brought it back with a breath of fresh air to say we need to habituate users to seeing familiar default state things here. And maybe they're ready to see something that's personalized over here, but within a finite number of options. And so where I want to step in is to say, and you know, we could definitely go over this in a further conversation. These cards right here are the touch point cards, content block, in-store display, search, alert bar, email based on time, email based on role. You know, these are all different parameters that you can think of for expressing the what. And that's just one of the spokes of this grammar. The who, you know, if I pull up my user segment category of cards, cohort, unknown, GUID, which is global unique identifier, default, authenticated, referred, guest, you know. So there's lots of different ways we can start to sort of distill down what seems like this oceanic thing of like, well, if I could personalize anything, do I have to personalize everything? No, please don't, you know? I like to say with Bucket Studio, we're interested in delivering shovel-ready simplifications and personalizations. And that even if you are listening to this and you think, you know, that's nice. That's nice for Patrick and Jeffrey to talk about this. This does not pertain to me. I have news for you. It does, because everyone who works in UX is in the business of simplification. We have these run-amok parameters by which a lot of our corporate functions, whether you're in a nonprofit or a behemoth big tech company, are hitting the publish button all day long. They have their own incentive models and they need to provide information or they need to make conversions happen. They need to generate revenue, whatever their purpose is. And we need to deliver experiences that will not overwhelm anyone, and you know, will uniquely serve everyone. So, and that's the definition, you know, of personalization for Accenture. Like if you strip away all of the like, we can do all these things. It's really to uniquely serve everyone without overwhelming anyone. And everyone's in that business, as far as I'm concerned. If you touch a product and you know, you've got customer experience anywhere near your title.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. Also, by the way, I love that quote from Accenture, which I think might be the first time I ever said that sentence before.